Good morning and welcome to this December 14th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast on iTunes and elsewhere. I am your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It is my pleasure to welcome one of my favorite novelists, Wally Lam, back to the show, and one of my new favorites, Mary Troy, to the show this morning. Wally is with me now. Mary will join in the second half. Wally Lam is, of course, the author of 5 New York Times best-selling novels, She's Come Undone, I Know This Much Is True, The Hour I First Believed, Wishin' and Hopin', and We Are Water. His first two works of fiction, She's Come Undone and I Know This Much Is True, were both New York Times bestsellers, both selections in Oprah's book club. Wally edited Couldn't Keep It to Myself and I'll Fly Away, 2 volumes of essays from students in his writer's workshop at York Correctional Institution, a women's prison in Connecticut, where he has been a volunteer facilitator for 17 years. He was on the show with me in 2007 talking about that. He joins me this morning from Connecticut to talk about his latest novel, number 6, I'll Take You There. It's published by Harper, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Wally, welcome back.
Hey, Marie, good to be with you again.
Good to be with you. We haven't talked in 10 years. I was telling you before, I went to look up our old interview thinking it was, 4 or 5 years ago. But no, it was a decade ago.
Yeah, I find the older I get, the faster time goes.
Right.
I don't suppose the globe is speeding up. I think it's just me slowing down.
I'm right there with you. So you have always been in some form a champion of women and of women's issues and women's rights. And, that's been a ribbon throughout your work. It's been a ribbon throughout your work at the women's prison and throughout this novel. And I just love and admire men who stand up for women. So I hope you talk about that, just about your pull towards the topic of feminism and women's issues over the course of your career.
Sure. Well, I think it stems back from my childhood. I grew up with older sisters and girl cousins who lived right next door, and it was a pretty female centric neighborhood. I was a little boy in the 50s when Dad went off to earn a paycheck and Mom stayed home with the kids, and so. Women and girls were sort of always looming in my childhood. I guess probably there's no such thing as the feminine mystique when you have a childhood like mine. Anyway, and then I worked with high school kids for about 25 years, and when I started writing myself, Marie, I threw out all that I thought I knew about how to teach writing. I taught high school English and suddenly I realized that, the writing is better and more interesting if instead of assigning topics, you help the kids figure out what they want to write about. And, of course, when you do that with adolescents, mostly they want to write about themselves. And so I was on the receiving end of a lot of, particularly from the girls, a lot of, personal essays, sometimes confessional. And so I think that sort of shaped me as well. It certainly shaped my comfort level as far as, when I started working with the women in prison.
Yeah.
And also, in terms of, this long election cycle and some of the ways that women have been knocked and, dissed, I was just really glad to be, on board for, as far as championing feminism, not only in the dedication, but also, in the storyline.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I always think books are born into the, you can't just look at a piece of literature in isolation. You look at it kind of in the world that it was born into. And you're right, with this election cycle, I think this novel is just coming out at, even a more wonderful time than if it came out 3 or 4 years ago, that all of these issues are, rearing their heads in sort of new ways, and it's fresh all over again.
Yeah. It's back on the table. All the gender stuff, at least I thought we were going to be celebrating the breaking of the big glass ceiling, but as it didn't happen. So we got to keep fighting the fight.
Right. not only not the breaking of the big glass ceiling, but like a new ceiling has been put down lower than
Yeah.
It's all the world.
Yeah, oddly and sadly enough, I think that's true in a lot of ways, not just, you know, the feminist angle, but, you know, in terms of, you know, racial awareness and, you know, immigration and all that. But
right.
But anyway, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, don't get us started on that.
I still do have my tie-dye shirt from the 70s. If I need to, I'll put it on and go out and march in the streets.
I think you might need to. okay, so let's let you introduce this book because you'll do it best. I kind of felt sorry for Felix at certain points, being surrounded by so many women. I'm like, man, this guy is really out there by himself. And Felix is a character of yore, so you know, he's coming back to us from one of your other novels. So anyway, take us there.
Right.
Tell us about
that. As you mentioned, Felix is a recurring character in my little Christmas novel, Wishin' and Hopin', that was published, I think, 2009, maybe.
Yeah.
He was a fifth-grade parochial school student, and I have grown him up now so that he is 60 years old, and he has become a professor of film studies. He's been a lifelong a fan of the movies, and this story actually has a genesis from Wishin' and Hopin', not just because of the character reintroduction, but also the fact that they made a film of Wishin' and Hopin', and it was premiered at the Gard Theater in New London, Connecticut, GARDE, that is.
Oh, my God.
And that's an old vaudeville theater that used to show silent movies back when it opened in 1926. And so we had a big fancy premiere. We all felt like big shots and so forth. And I was talking to the managers of this theater, which has been beautifully refurbished in the old Moroccan style of the old, you know, great movie palaces. Anyway, I was talking to the managers, and they said, "Oh, you know, we have had ghost sightings at this theater." And I sort of took that and ran with it, and started doing my homework as far as silent movies and so forth. And I discovered a wonderful. She had been a real person, a mover and shaker in early Hollywood. Her name was Lois Weber, and she was just a fascinating woman, very accomplished. She was a producer. She was a director. She liked to do films of social uplift, they were called. And so she took on subject matter such as women's reproductive rights and, the pay discrepancy between men and women and so forth. So she was really ahead of her time. What was sad to me was that she's sort of fallen by the wayside, whereas, you know, people like D.W. Griffith and Florence Ziegfeld, you know, they're all sort of celebrated these days. But poor Lois had kind of been forgotten. So I decided to bring her back, you know, given that the Gard Theater has, may or may not be haunted. I decided to make Lois a ghost who is sort of mentoring Felix on women's issues and reminding him that women are not to be dismissed.
Right. Perfect. Perfect. And this is a meta book. I hadn't really even clued in on meta books. Meta book, as I'm saying. Yeah. So tell us about that.
Well, actually, this project began as a meta book. It's a startup company, and what they do is, they take your story, and then they add all kinds of media, everything from documentary material to a soundtrack and an audio performance, kind of like an old radio play. So in the meta book version, you can read it on your iPad or your iPhone, but you can also, as you're reading or instead of reading, you can listen to the story being performed by people like Kathleen Turner, who plays Lois Weber's ghost, and Laura Benanti, a Broadway star, and Dana Delaney, Jeremy Sisto. So, there's all kinds of cool sort of features. It's basically an enhanced reading experience via, an app from the Apple Store.
That is very cool. Is this a big thing now? I hadn't even heard of this.
No, I think it's. I think it has the potential to fly and be a big thing, but that kind of depends. You know, it's kind of a brand new use of the technology, a brand new way to read. You know, some I still like to read books. You know, between covers, and that's available too through HarperCollins. But you know, I know a lot of people, particularly younger people. I think I have millennial age sons, and they you know they sort of absorb media differently than I do, whereas I can sit there and, you know, read several chapters in a traditional book for, you know, a couple of hours. They've got their iPod, you know, their buds in their ears, and they're watching ESPN on a television set, and they're you know, doing emails. So yeah. I don't think it's a sort of a matter of attention deficit disorder or anything like that. I just think that young people you know, can do several things at once media-wise. So, yeah. So anyway, we'll see if it flies or not. But I just, you know, I'm just really pleased that readers of all kinds can receive the story the way they like to.
Yeah, it's a very cool concept, and it got me thinking that, as you say, there are a lot of different ways to absorb media, and I was thinking of all the different strengths of each way that you communicate and film. You know, I was thinking about this novel being a novel about film and how, you know, through the media of film, you can communicate so many different things in a different way. And now absorbing a book through different means in a different way, I think is really wonderful and kind of mirrors the book in that, you know, we're talking about film in a book. Now we're talking about books in a meta book.
Right. Yeah.
Kind of a cool thing.
There's a little documentary. It's about a maybe 7 or 8 minute documentary that sort of catches you up on who Lois Weber was and what her accomplishments were, and you know has some old photo and a little bit of footage from some of those early movies. So it's kind of like animated Wikipedia. You know, if you want to take a break from the story and learn about Lois Weber, you can do that, or you can wait till the end, that kind of thing. And so it's kind of fun. I hope people enjoy it. I really enjoyed collaborating with the MetaBook guys, and I'm also really grateful that HarperCollins jumped in and wanted to make a traditional book as well.
Yeah, very cool. My guest this morning is Wally Lamb. The book is I'll Take You There. It's published by Harper, and out as a MetaBook. Did you know when you were writing Wishin' and Hopin' that Felix, either he wasn't done with you or you weren't done with him? Was that always kind of in the back of your mind that this is a character I can do more with, or he kind of continues to haunt me?
No, I didn't plan this at all, but I think probably in retrospect, the reason why I kind of wanted to pick up with the story of Felix and his family, the Funicellos, is that of all the characters that I have written and created, he's probably the closest to me in my autobiography. You know, he grows up with two older sisters, as did I. He comes from Eastern Connecticut, as do I. And he's roughly my age. I think I made him about 4 or 5 years younger than I am. But yeah, I know that terrain. I know the setting. And I just decided, as long as it was going to be about movies, and as long as I had said in the wrap up of Wishin' and Hopin' that Felix went on in his adulthood to be a professor of film studies, I thought, I'll rather than create a new character, I'll just rejoin Felix and his family. And it was kind of fun to go back there, although tonally it's different. This story is a little bit different. Wishin' and Hopin' was kind of lighthearted. I had just finished, when I started Wishin' and Hopin', I had finished a novel that took me 9 years to write, something called The Hour I First Believed, and very serious subject matter. It begins with the Columbine tragedy and sort of takes off from there. And, it was a long, tough book to have written. And I was just looking to walk on the sunny side of the street for a bit. So that's where Wishin' and Hopin' came from. Now, I thought I was going to stay on the sunny side of the street with this one, but then it gets a little darker, gets a little edgier as the story goes on. One of Felix's sisters, who's just a minor character in Wishin' and Hopin', begins to take center stage. She's a troubled adolescent who develops anorexia nervosa at a time back in the 60s, sort of pre-Karen Carpenter time, when nobody really knew much about this disease. And the family thinks that they're the only ones going through this horrible thing, and of course it's a big secret. This happens with a lot of households where the parents say, you know, what goes on in this house stays in this house.
Right.
And so Felix has this, you know, really scary thing happening to his sister, and he has nowhere to go with it.
Right. Right. Yeah, you're right. The book starts out in a much different kind of tone or voice than it, or not voice, but tone that it, than it goes into, which I kind of thought was its strength. I mean, you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you really lean in, and then you're, you know, and then you're caught up in this world that gets a little bit darker and darker. Although I would say, you know, it's a really, it felt like a very playful novel. I mean, it really felt like you were having so much fun, and it felt like you were, you kind of knew all the writing rules and then felt kind of free to play with them and break them in certain cases. And I it just felt like you were having fun. I don't know if that's how it felt on the other side of the table.
You know, it really did. And part of the fun, Marie, comes from the nostalgia quotient. You know, I adore pop culture, and not only pop culture from, you know, the present, but also from the past. And I find that these are kind of, at least for me, they're triggers that sort of open up memories. You know, when you listen to an old song from the 60s or the 70s, and all of a sudden, you know, who you were back then comes flooding back. Or, you know, of course, it happens with films, or, you know, what were current events back there and back then, and, you know, who the idols were. On television, I have this sort of weird memory where I don't remember significant things like dates in history and stuff, but I could sing you the entire theme song of the Beverly Hillbillies, that kind of thing.
Right.
So this is all sort of locked in my consciousness. For better or worse.
It's funny you should say that, because, you know, I make notes all over the book, and I have this big note at the front. Nostalgia is palpable throughout.
You're right. That's me having a good time with it.
Yeah. That's how it felt. Yeah, that's how it felt. And there's sort of this magical realism quality to it. And I don't know, I can't remember you playing around with that in the past, but, you know, there's the ability of these old film directors to take Felix back into, you know, it's kind of, this is your life as directed by these women.
Right.
And, you know, they're able to take him inside his own life, inside his own movies. And have you played with magical, would you call it magic realism? I don't even know what word to give it.
I would call it that. I'm a big admirer of the writers who go there with magic realism. A lot of the South American and Central American writers will play with, fantastic elements in an otherwise sort of realistic setting. I would say probably the closest I've come to that before was in my second novel, I Know This Much Is True, and that has a couple of I dip my toe in the water of magic realism in that book in a much quicker way. But this one, you know, Felix is not only able to watch these old movies of his life, but he can go up to the screen and touch the big screen at the Guard Theater, and he gets sucked back into his past. So I kind of like that. I played around with it. People have said to me, that's sort of like Woody Allen's the Something Rose of Cairo, I think it was. Dickens' Christmas Carol. But really the one that I was thinking of was a play that I used to study with my high school kids way back when, and that is Thornton Wilder's Our Town.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a depiction of mundane middle class life, and then all of a sudden in Act Three, you see people, you know, in the afterlife, those same characters. And I've always loved that technique. And he, you know, and the fact that in that play, Wilder also sort of takes the conventions and then begins to break them and play around with them and see what happens.
Right. And it's really funny. There's so much great humor.
Yeah, right.
Which also felt like you having fun. I mean, there's so much great dialogue and sort of the Felix turning to the reader and the audience and, you know, let me tell you about this.
Yeah. Well, I think some of that stuff, I think I love to write dialogue. A lot of writing is really hard for me and very humbling, but I always have a good time when I'm writing dialogue. I think probably it comes from nothing more noble than the fact that I watched way too much TV when I was a kid, and so dialogue, conversations between characters, I really enjoy writing that.
That's funny you should say that, because that's really where I struggle. And believe me, I watch plenty of TV as a kid, and it's dialogue is a talent. I mean, being able to, you know, to distill down exactly what characters need to convey, not in a way that people would actually speak, is just a talent, and it's
right. Yeah. Well, I really admire screenwriters too, and yeah. Having written a screenplay for my first novel, She's Come Undone, I see how difficult that is, because of course it boils down to, you know, the dialogue and stage direction, and that's a whole different game than the one that I usually play when I'm writing a novel.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you've ever dabbled in that. I didn't know you did the screenplay for. I know that that's.
And I've also, two or three of my novels have been screen projects, and so I've always sort of enjoyed, you know, giving feedback on on the screenplays that get written. I think I can tell you this. There's a really cool thing happening with I Know This Much Is True, which is my second novel about identical twin brothers, and that is being readied for a limited series, like maybe a 10 or 12 episode series, that being a very long, thick book that runs to 900 pages.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, and the thing that's thrilling for me is that Mark Ruffalo, the great actor Mark Ruffalo, is going to play the twins, and I've gotten to know him a little bit. He's a great guy, and I think he's going to be perfect for that role.
That is great. Congratulations. That is
one
of my.
Thank you.
That book got me through a whole month of my pregnancy, so I really
whole
month of bed. I love that book.
It could have probably gotten you through 9 months if you slowed down a little bit. one time I was doing a signing with that book, and this little old lady, she was very sweet. She comes up and she plunks the book down for to get it signed, and she said, "I like this book, but it's too heavy." And I said, "Oh, I know, it's so unreasonably long, isn't it?" And she said, "No, I didn't say it's too long." She said, "I said it's too heavy. I like to read in bed with the book resting on my stomach, and your book hurt my stomach." So I said, "You know, it doesn't take much for me to feel guilty." So I was apologizing all over the place, and she said, "No, I found the solution to this." She said, "When I finish a page on both sides, I just rip it out. So the further into the book I get, the lighter it gets, and it's fine." So she said, "You can pass that on to your other readers." So here I am doing that with you, Marie.
Well, at 9 months pregnant, I had no problem, holding it up on my
stomach. Right. Could have probably induced labor.
Yeah, right.
That's
funny. That's great news. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You know, one of the other things that I loved about this was the pull between the generations that you've got, you know, the Gen Y daughter. I think she's in Gen Y. And,
yeah,
you know,
she
with,
is, yeah.
with her feminist mom and you know, what all the struggles that her grandmother and aunts and whatnot went through. And I really liked that dialogue. I was wondering if there was a generation, I assume your own generation, you would understand the best. But if there was a generation in those women that stuck you more than others, you know, that you just couldn't access Elisa's mentality, or if the aunts were, you know, who gave you the problems here?
Well, Yeah, I was sort of flying in the dark, but you know, I have sons who are in their early 30s, so I believe that qualifies them as Gen Y. They both, two of my three sons live in New Orleans, and one of them is a slam poet, my son Justin, and so he's very much, you know, involved with the scene down there. He has a lot of friends who are stand-up comics and, you know, sketch actors and that kind of thing. So I was sort of tapping him on this, and he's the one who told me about polyamory, which that was not a term that I knew. So you know, I had a couple of little leads to follow there, and then you know, I began to study, you know, what third wave feminism is all about. You know, people who are, you know, in their 20s and 30s who are feminists. It's different than the feminism that came out of, you know, the Betty Friedan book and so forth, because it's, first of all, very much plugged into social media, and secondly, it's a more global kind of thing than just a, you know, a U.S. Kind of phenomenon. So that millennial feminists are interested in stopping genital mutilation and fat shaming and that kind of stuff, and they can, of course, you know, create a flash mob whenever they need to, and you know, march in the streets, you know, in a parade that's called the Slut Walk, which whereby women, you know, dress very provocatively, but wear signs saying, you know, this does not give you permission to rape me, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I got an education by creating the character of Eliza. And, yeah, of course, you know, she swears a lot, too. At one point, I have Felix, you know, say to her, you know, geez, you sound like an HBO character.
Right.
But I did have fun with that dialogue, and, you know, teasing her and teasing him for his sort of old fuddy-duddiness.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so fun. So fun. I loved it. we're drawing down on our time. Never enough time. I was wondering if over the course of, you know, writing for the period of time you've written now, if you find your areas of concern changing, or if you find yourself still captivated by some of the same stuff that's captivated you your whole life, or, you know, kind of this growth as writer, what's changed and what stayed the same?
Well, I think aging has made me more self-reflective. I'm 66 as of this past October, and you know, you can now, I'm at an age where you can take a look at the, you know, at the long you know, period of your life, and you know, who you were when you were a kid, and who you were when you were an adolescent, and so forth. So, I think self-reflection is one thing. I think I think my next novel is going to take up the possibility, probability, improbability of an afterlife, and so I think that probably is not something I would have been that interested in when I was in my 30s. And I would say probably the other thing besides that is what's happening, again, we're sort of coming full circle here, what's happening politically right now. I think in some ways it's feeling very full circle to when I was coming of age and, you know, going out in the streets and marching for, you know, social justice and, you know, anti-war and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think I'm ready to fight that fight if it becomes necessary, and I'm hoping that that others, you know, will as well, because you know, I think we're entering into a potentially dangerous period as far as, you know, where the country might be led.
Amen. Yeah. It's going to take all of us, I think.
Yeah.
I love having you on. I can't wait for your next
one. Oh, thank you. I love talking to you. You know, it's like chatting with an old friend, and I really appreciate that, Marie.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Okay.
That was Wally Lamb. The book, I'll Take You There, is published by Harper. It is out and available now. We are going to take a very short break. Mary Troy will be with me for the second half. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. She has direct downloads, hundreds and hundreds, like almost 20 years worth of shows now, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows. There are some incredible speaker series events coming up in January and February. There's information about those up there and more. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward, onward. Mary Troy is with me now. She is the author of 4 books of fiction, the novel Beauties, and 3 collections of short stories, Cookie Lily, The Alibi Cafe and Other Stories, and Joe Baker is Dead. She teaches fiction writing and contemporary literature at the MFA program at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, where she edits Natural Bridge, a journal of contemporary literature. Her latest novel is Swimming on Highway N. It is published by Moon City Press, and it's my huge pleasure to chat with her this morning. Mary, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I love this book. This was really, these women are wonderful. These women are up my alley. So I'm just going to let you talk about it so our listeners know what the heck is going on and kind of take us into Swimming on Highway N, what motivated the book and kind of the scope of the novel.
Okay. Well, Swimming on Highway N begins with Madeline Dames, who is 60, and she is thrice widowed and moves. She leaves her high rise on Lake Michigan and moves to Bourbon, Missouri, which is a tiny little place it's like the tip of what they call the Ozark Plateau. It's the beginning of the hills in Missouri, and she moves there just for difference, just because she wants to see who she's going to be now. And it turns out that her younger sister, they were both abused by their mother. They had a rather rough childhood. Her younger sister, who is 50, shows up, and she has legally changed her name to Misery to indicate how sad she is with her life. And then pretty soon, a man that Madeline has met in town, who she hopes might be husband number 4, shows up with 2 young people, and the guy is a deserter. He does not want to be redeployed to Iraq. This is in 2005, when many young men were making this decision. And so Randy, the older man that Madeline has a crush on, is going to help try to get them all to Canada, thinking maybe it will be safer, although Canada is not as easy as it was in the Vietnam era. The young man has made himself kind of a target by some incendiary letters to the editors that are reprinted in newspapers, and it's during that time in 05 when the world was quite polarized. The people were either, yes, you know, we should be in Iraq, and many people were saying, my God, what are we doing? And so he's become a target of some really right-wing groups. So they start out. They're eventually chased. Madeline's crazy mother, abusive mother, ends up joining them, and another man from town, and they're chased across the country by some patriot groups and by a young man who they insult. He's a waiter in Nebraska City, and they insult him because his brother is fighting in Iraq. And they pick up a hitchhiker who has some brain damage and can't stop eating. They end up with a dog that gets sick in the back of the car. They have a renegade nun and on the Blackfoot Reservation with some teenagers, and so they all end up in Ritzville, Washington, which is where the penultimate scene takes place.
I love it. I love it. You know, it's so ambitious. I mean, as you're talking about it, I'm realizing anew, and I thought it as I read it, it's such an ambitious book. I mean, it's a huge, you know, interesting, big cast of characters whose point of view you really get to access throughout. You know, we kind of get into the minds of all of them. And so tell me, first of all, tell me the point of entry. Like, because I know normally you're a short story writer, and the landscape of a novel is so very different than the landscape of a short story. So tell me kind of the point of entry and what made you realize, you know, this is way too big for a short story and you know, that it was going to become a novel.
All right. I had finished a novel when I started writing this. I had finished Beauties, and Beauties took me quite a while. And I thought, well, maybe I've learned something. Maybe this, I can write another novel that will go a little faster, which was, of course, a mistake. And but I thought so at the time. But in the beginning, I just sort of started playing around with character because, as you say, I'm mostly a short story writer. I believe everything is character, that character drives the stories. Character is why we read. Characters stay in my head much longer than plots do from many novels and stories I read. Yep. So I started sort of playing around with Madeline. And the thing that I fixated on first was she had a baby. She became pregnant when she was 16 in order to get away from her home. And I hadn't heard of a woman who did that when I was young. And, of course, it had to be back in the 60s because now if a girl gets pregnant, well, she doesn't necessarily feel she has to marry the boy. And so you don't have these childhood weddings anymore. But back in the 60s, especially in sort of the Midwest Catholicism, that's what happened. And Madeline understood she would get away from home if she got pregnant, she would be part of this other family. So I started playing around with the woman who would do that, and I realized I wanted her to be looking back on it, not set in the 60s, mostly because I wanted some wisdom. I didn't want it. Just, the story was so obvious otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept, but I didn't know what was going to happen to Madeline, and then I don't know, just playing around and giving her a sister and figuring out who her mother was. Suddenly, I realized that the young man, that Henry, could show up, and I don't really know where he came from. But when he came to her door and wanted help, then I thought, okay, now I have a novel.
Yeah.
Now there's a plot to this.
Right. Now you have characters in opposition to each other with
kind of opposing
needs.
And some movement.
Yeah, and some movement. Right, right. Yeah, it's funny. I had read somewhere that you had said that you often write character sketches, and I love this. You said, I hear them speak, I see inside their heads and hearts, and I listen to their lies. And I think that's such a great way to access character, about what they're lying about, what they're keeping secret. And these characters just have such a well of secrets, you know, almost even from themselves. I mean, these girls' childhood was so brutal that, you know, it's almost as though they have to, you know, either lie to themselves or I don't know about how they grew up. But I just love that as a point of entry into a character, is to understand not only what they want and kind of the basic things that writers talk about, but also what they're lying about and what they're keeping from each other.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, that's one of the most interesting and fun parts of writing is in the beginning when the characters start talking to you. And I write all that in longhand usually, and I can do like three or four reams of legal size paper just letting them talk to me and tell me about their lives and see what's going on with them.
Yeah, yeah. There's so much great symbolism here too. So the cover of the book will give you the opening image, which is of this woman laying in a kiddie pool on the side of a highway, in her bikini, an old, you know, the woman in her 60s. And that I kind of, you know, took to be the womb. She, you know, I mean, she's laying in kind of this little contained pool of water, which feels sort of womb-like. And, of course, she had this horrible relationship with her mother and kind of the, you know, the mothering womb she never really had. And there, throughout the novel, there are just so many wonderful symbols like that of blindness and of, you know, this van that all this crap happens to.
You know, yeah.
And I'm wondering about the symbolism and metaphors throughout the book, if those just came to you organically, or if you kind of think, okay, what symbols would really work for these women, or what would really work for this story, or if those things just kind of, you know, come out of the bubble of your subconscious.
I think they come out of the bubble of my subconscious, or at least I mean, well, in fact, I know they do. But then I decide if I should keep them and if they'll work. So they show up, and then in a draft, third or fourth draft, I usually decide, oh, yes, I see. This could work this way. I can use this, and then I will emphasize it more or just drop it.
Yeah, yeah. So many great things in here. Let's talk a little bit about Wanda, because she was, you know, just one of my favorite characters, because she's so horrible and weird. So wonderfully weird and horrible. So she's, you know, we couldn't put her in the likable category generally, but a really very interesting category. And so tell me a little bit about mining her character and keeping her on the side of, you know, sympathetic enough, understanding enough, but, you know, she's very funny, and kind of humanizing her, how you humanize kind of, you know, bad characters.
Well, I suppose one thing just generally is bad characters. I don't really think there are any bad characters so much as human characters. I mean, I really believe all of us have almost everything in us, and if looked at from one side, we're horrible, and if looked at from the other side, we aren't quite so horrible. However, Wanda is mostly bad, and I didn't want her to be sympathetic exactly, because though she's had a rough childhood, that's, you know, and raised during the Depression and sort of hated in the little town, it doesn't mean that she has an excuse to be so horrible to her own daughters and to other people that she knows. It explains her a little, but I realized that as I got into her head, she had a strange sense of humor, and it took me by surprise, too, and I thought, where did that sense of humor come from? But I sort of figured out it's part of her toughness. She's been alone all her life, or at least that's the way she sees it. No one has helped her. No one has come to her aid. And so she's her only friend in a way.
Yeah.
And so I think that gave her a toughness, and out of that toughness came her sense of humor.
Right, right. And your dialogue is just wonderful. I was just saying in the first half hour that, you know, I really struggle with dialogue and making characters sound authentic and different enough from each other and funny. She's really, a lot of these characters are really very funny. And I think the opposite side, you know, the mirror side of pain is often humor. And, it, you know, I think without humor in this book, it would be very kind of hard to take these characters, you know, and take what they've been through and... it really lent itself so well to the to the humor that you put into it. Talk a little bit about writing dialogue. I assume, do you read it out loud? How do you get these characters' voices right?
I don't know that there's really a magic trick to it, but yes, I do read it out loud. I want to know how they will say things. And I'm not entirely sure always that that even what they say is deliberate. I think that also sort of bubbles up once I get to know the characters. And they say things, and I say, oh, yeah, that's it. And then sometimes they say things, and I say, no, you know, Wanda wouldn't say it that way, or Misery wouldn't say it that way. And then I realize that I have forgotten the character, that the character is no longer the important thing when that happens.
Oh, I love that trick. Yeah, I love that trick. Not a trick, really, but a method of kind of checking your work. A mathematical proof where you go backwards through it and say, okay, it's not adding up to the whole here. That's great. My guest this morning is Mary Troy. The book is Swimming on Highway N. It is published by Moon City Press. Were there points on the journey that tripped you up? Kind of where in the book were the sticking points? And let's talk about working through the sticking points. I really like novels that are set on a journey to write, because it feels like, you know, there's kind of a narrative arc built into the journey itself. But I don't know if that felt true for you, or if it felt like there were, you know, points on their trip where you were like, God, how am I going to get them out of here?
No, it's, I never worried about how to get them out. I sometimes worried about how to make it harder, how, what sort of obstacles to put in their way. And I did believe in the beginning that, oh, since this is going to be a journey novel, it will be much easier than my previous novel, and it will go very, very smoothly. And it didn't entirely. And part of that was the point of view. I decided sort of early on that I didn't want to just tell it from Madeline's point of view. I wanted to go into Misery's mind and Wanda's mind and Henry and Lizette and Randy and even Eugene the hitchhiker. I wanted to go into all of their heads. And that was difficult. That's a very difficult thing to do, and I think I made my journey harder that way. Although I liked it, I thought it worked. I wanted, but I came very close to losing Madeline at one point when I was doing all that. And there was a draft when I had to go back and sort of reinvigorate her, give her more life, because for a while she sort of faded into the background, and I didn't want that at all, because it is truly her journey.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's interesting that that the main character, I hadn't thought about that, but as I'm looking back over it now, that's true, that the main character could be at risk of getting lost amongst the sea of voices, because it really is a big chorus of voices. And yet, it, you know, we know that it is really her story. So keeping her in the forefront, but the rest of the cast in the very near back, I think would be one of the challenges of this. That's interesting. How many, over the course of what period of time did you write this?
Oh, I would say I started it in probably 2009. My novel Beauties didn't come out till 2010, but it had already been accepted, so I assumed that, okay, now I'm a novelist, maybe I'll start another one. Although I wrote a draft of this, and it went very, very fast. The first draft really did go fast, but it was a bad draft, and so it took me a long time to get back to it. Then I did some more short stories, and I thought, well, I'll let that sit for a while and see. So it was a more difficult book than I expected it to be, partly because I did keep shifting and sort of digging down deeper into the characters and their points of view. And then because I seldom gave it my full attention until near the end.
Yeah. I mean, this is the most supreme compliment possible, but it really feels like a hard book to write. I mean, it's so layered and textured and, like I say, so many people and, you know, kind of complicated points of view that it feels like it would be very, I would get lost. It feels like it would be very complicated. I don't know what your office looks like, if you have sort of character arcs somehow on the walls, or kind of how you kept track of kind of each person's mental state as they were moving, or if you just kind of keep moving through the drafts forward and it, you know, kind of takes care of itself that way.
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I kept moving through the draft forward, and then with every new draft, I would look for specific things. I would look for if I could chart the character arcs. And really, this book, I would dream about it, and I would wake up in the morning and say, okay, something's wrong. I wonder, can I just tell the story of Misery to myself? Can I just tell the story of Wanda to myself? Can I get this? And it really drove me crazy, almost crazy, for nearly a year. That was like at the end of the fourth or fifth draft when it really started to sink in, and I couldn't shake it. I thought, well, I have to make this a good book, or, you know, or nothing. I mean, I didn't have a choice.
Right, right.
It wouldn't, I mean, I couldn't just quit.
It wouldn't let you go, yeah, right. Which I think is the mark of, you know, novels that have to be written. I mean, that's what they say, you know, you've got to have a book that has to be told. And this did have that urgency of feeling like this has to be told, this has to be out in the world. That's great. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Mary Troy. The book is Swimming on Highway N. I feel like we can't not talk about the setting because this is a part of the country I've never been to. I don't know anything about. I haven't even read a lot of books set in this part of the country. And yet I felt completely immersed in it. And so much so, it was funny that I came across some article about the book and it had a Google Map photograph of the stretch of highway that, you know, they may have lived off of. And I'm like, yeah, of course. That's exactly what it looks like. I already know that. I already know what it looks like. So I'd love for you to talk about place, bringing the place to life. If there were any parts of that that gave you difficulty or, you know, kind of advice on how to make a place a character and bring it so much to life.
Well, no, Bourbon, Missouri didn't give me any difficulty at all. I live in St. Louis, and it's about an hour and a half southwest of town, and my husband and I, we went to graduate school many, many years ago at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. So when we would drive back and forth to St. Louis, we would pass the Bourbon exit. Since then we have gone to Bourbon. We've driven around there. We are backwoods, back roads drivers. We've even tried to get into Bourbon one direction on a road that ended and just became mud and gravel. So I know the area. And it's a beautiful, it's just a really beautiful part of the state. It's like many little towns, it's poor. It's almost empty now. It does not have a cafe. It doesn't have Bee's Cafe in it, although in my mind I think it should. But it's beautiful nonetheless. And so it was an easy place for me to set a story. It's always sort of impressed me, that whole area.
Yeah.
When I was much, much younger, I backpacked around Europe, as many people my age did, and I remember there are little scenes in Austria that look to me now very much like street roads and vistas that I encounter in and around Bourbon, Missouri. Just the hills in the background and the valleys and the little streams. It is really just fantastically beautiful.
It strikes me as a really fun place to mine as a writer because, you know, unlike New York or Chicago or L.A. that have been written about ad nauseum, and what the heck else could you say about New York that hasn't been said?
Yes.
You know, this really feels like fresh territory for readers, at least, who, you know, are somewhat unfamiliar with the background, but it just feels like really the heart of the United States. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true, and so it's my niche now.
Yeah,
I might be the only novel out, especially this year, that's set in Bourbon, Missouri.
I love that. Yeah, you have all these Southern novelists. You're the Missouri, you're the official Missouri novelist, Bourbon, Missouri novelist. I just love the town name too. I mean that there is a town called Bourbon is fantastic. Oh, there's never enough time. We're drawing down. But I wonder if there, I know you are a professor as well as a writing teacher, as well as a novelist, short story writer. So over the course of all of that, is there advice you can leave writers with that can sustain us into the new year?
Well, I would say write. I think writing is immensely important. Fiction tells the truth better than almost anything I know. And it's important now, more than ever, to tell the truth. It's important to give people something to enhance and improve their lives, as a good piece of fiction does. And I think, you know, work on it. It's fun, even if nothing happens with it. It's fun. It's fun to develop characters. It's don't put it off. Just write.
Boy, I couldn't echo that more. I was telling somebody through the course of the past year horror show in politics that I've turned more now to poetry than I had in the past. I mean, I've always read a little bit of poetry, but, you know, kind of like eating broccoli, I felt like it was good for me. And now I really feel like it's sort of sustaining me. And that's become the case for fiction, too. Your point about fiction being more true than anything and, you know, this world we're living in of fake news and all of that. To find the emotional truths and the emotional chords in fiction ringing more true than nonfiction ringing true That's really striking a chord with me. You're exactly right. And I think and art now is more important than maybe ever before. Or, you know, it's
it is, recently. And it's going to be ignored more than ever before too. But we have to accept that and just keep doing it.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. Mary Troy, this was an enormous pleasure. I love this book. I love these characters.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inventing this world. It was really, really a pleasure. That was Mary Troy. The novel is Swimming on Highway N. It is out now. It is available by Moon City Press. It is wonderful. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Fanny Flagg is going to be on. She had written Fried Green Tomatoes back in the day. She's out with a new novel and another collection of short stories, which you know I love. So stay tuned for that next Wednesday morning at 9. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.